Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Tessa Niles, how are you?
I'm good, Dave. How are you?
I'm good, very good indeed. So I'll tell you now why you're on the programme here, because it's just incredible when I look at this. Because when it comes to music, all the attention from press and the audience is generally on the lead singer or the main artist in the band. Rarely does the light shine brightly on those who contribute so much to music. And I'm talking about backing singers. They remain in the shadows, their work often uncredited, unnoticed even, and yet they are present and contribute to some of the most important moments in music history. Well, you're a backing singer who over the past 30 years has performed with, I mean, and has toured with as well. I mean, I'm just going to give you, I'm going to take a big breath here, okay? Here it goes. ABC, Eric Clapton, The Rolling Stones, Annie Lennox, Tears for Fears, Duran Duran, Kylie Minogue, David Bowie, The Police, Take That, Grace Jones, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Tina Turner, Steve Winwood, Snowy White, Wham, Gary Newman, Dusty Springfield, Cher, The There, Seal, Liza Minnelli, John Denver, Status Quo, Robbie Williams, Buddy Guy, Cliff Richard, Marillion, and Tom Jones, and there's loads more. How you've had time to do anything else, I do not know. But look, seriously, before we even talk about any one of those and anecdotes and whatever, take me back to the very beginning, Tessa, before you became a backing singer. You were singing in pubs, were you?
Singing in pubs, but even before that, Dave, harmonies were the thing, you know, for me, just the thing that fired me up, singing with my brother, you know, that sibling blend, just loving it. There was nothing else for me but music. And I was so fortunate to be able to meet up with some people who basically started me in pubs. And from there, I guess I sang in pubs for about a year. And then I had a huge break, which catapulted me from singing in front of 100 people, which I thought was kind of making it. Not going to lie, I was entirely happy with that. To then a week later finding myself singing in front of 40,000 people in the States.
Okay, well, now that's a step up, most definitely, from singing just one cornetto on the back of the car with Ian, or basically singing to the shy lights. Have you seen her as you roller skated? That's your youth all gone now in one question.
That's it.
Okay, that's very good. So, like where it all started, and like you were singing, like just in singing in the pubs, by the way, or singing in the sort of better places, the late 70s and the early 80s, was it a good place? And I get the impression it was, for if you're, and mostly female, but if you're a young female singer and pretty good, there's gigs in nightclubs in London.
Oh, there was tons of gigs, so much for singers to do. I mean, the session industry had been going a long time, probably since the 50s, 60s. Yeah. And I was a new kid on the block, if you like. And that was quite a closed shop to get into, that kind of studio singing. But live singing, gosh, there was just so much. So many pubs, so many venues. Yeah, it was... The world
a lot of the time, I mean, one of the things you always loved, and you talk about it in terms of your family as well as later on, you like to sing in a group, or you like to be in a group or be part of a group or a bunch of other people all having a job to do.
Yeah, it was just the bliss of hearing different voices blending together was just amazing for me. In fact, I didn't sing a lead vocal until I was at least kind of 16, 17 years old. So throughout my childhood, it was the thing that fired me up. It was the thing that I listened out for on records. You know, I scoured the backs of the albums to see who was singing the backing vocals. It was just that thing that gave me bliss.
And that would be like record collections that you had at home that weren't necessarily yours. So if you just jump forward then, let's take a look. Somebody says, was it Marcia Hunt that started you off?
Kind of was, in a way. She got me a huge break. That I was talking about going from pubs to singing in stadiums.
Yeah.
She had called my then boyfriend and said, listen, can Tessa get down to a studio for this afternoon? It was all very cryptic. You know, nobody was really saying much. No names were mentioned. And so I donned on my best ripped jeans and shoulder pads, and off I went down to a studio in North London. And before I knew it, I was meeting, completely unannounced, there was nobody there to introduce me to them, but to Sting and Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers. And
okay. Hold on, there was somebody there, because you knocked on the door and Sting opens the door, yeah?
He does. I mean, I was standing outside this giant steel door and I heard these strains of what I think now was Roxanne. And I was like, okay, so the penny was starting to drop. And then Sting opened the door.
So you do your singing bit and you go along with whatever, and they're getting ready for the Synchronicity tour, which turned out to be their last, although you weren't, I mean, their last until they came back much later, but you weren't to know that. And then you had to go on tour with them pretty quickly too. But in between the singing and the going on tour, you're standing around a piano in Sting's North London apartment, and you're all trying to sing and get a few things together. And you realise he's got certain demands in terms of voices. And then you chime in and go, hey, I'll tell you, that sounds like very like country music. Just tell me about that moment of when the whole world stopped for you.
Yeah, well, it literally did, Dave, before I thought I was going to grab my coat even before I'd got the gig, because Sting started to play Every Breath You Take. And any harmony singer, probably most people know that that's a relatively easy song to sing along with and harmonize. And for some reason, I felt the need to say something. And I said, wow, Sting, I love this. It really has the kind of country and Western voicings. And everything stopped. He stopped playing the piano. He looked at me. And just I just thought, okay, well, I'll get my coat. That's it. I've blown this big time. And thankfully, after about 30 seconds of excruciating pain, he threw his head back and said, "Why, hey, Chet, you know, grab your coat. You're coming on tour."
Yeah, very northeast of England, all right. No question about it. So on that level then, you had to learn every single Police song in about 5 days, and suddenly you're on the road in America.
Yeah, Baptism by Fire. I mean, I was a complete rookie. I was 22 years old, really hadn't done too much other than the pubs. And here we now were on Concord, flying over to Chicago for the first gig. And then it was limos and jets and full-on rock and roll lifestyle.
But was it very difficult to jump in? There's two things about it. Number one, it was the Synchronicity tour. And the Synchronicity song opens the gig. And it's a very difficult song to do. But also, he says, you know, no vibrato. So, you know, in other words, you know, what you have to do is push as hard as possible from the word go.
Exactly right. And in fact, what Sting wanted was for us to sound like him, because the kind of brief of the gig was that he could lean on us. So every now and again, if he didn't want to sing something or didn't want to sing a part, you know, he had three Stings behind him, essentially. And Sting sings full on with not much vibrato. And so that was so challenging. In fact, I blew my voice kind of towards the end of the tour, because vibrato helps you kind of your voice stay in shape, really, and stops it from getting damaged. But we did it, and it was tough. But needless to say, he never kind of really lent on us. He sang everything.
Right. I want to jump forward a few bits, because obviously, like at Live Aid, on stage with David Bowie, where he brilliantly says thanks to you and gets your name wrong. I know that you were a part of everything he even did that day, because he even said, "What songs will I do?" And is it true that you actually said, "Do Rebel Rebel," because at school you were called Webel Webel?
I like to think that's true. Yeah. At school, my maiden name is Webb. Yeah. And so when Rebel Rebel came out, that was kind of, you know, fodder for my friends to start singing Webel Webel. And so that had kind of, I'd carried that with me. And when we were in the studio rehearsing for Live Aid, David had said, "So what song do you think we should do?" And I immediately piped up, "Well, you got to do Rebel Rebel." And he kind of looked and said, yeah, that would be a good one. And it ended up being in the set. And I like to think it was because, you know, of my suggestion. I didn't tell him about my, you know, my whole story behind it. But I like to think that, yeah, maybe he did it because I asked.
Okay, you also, I mean, from Live Aid, here, I'm going to play a tiny bit of this now. You have to listen and strain a little, but you'll hear Tessa here. You ready? Listen, hold on.
Back in the USSR.
Okay, the video, the song, Dancing in the Street, as in the version by Mick Jagger and David Bowie together for the Live Aid time. You worked on that as well, didn't you?
I did. And it was all done so quickly because there was no lead-in time before Live Aid. And I think it was done the day before. And the video was actually recorded and filmed the night, same night after the studio recording. So it was mad. It was absolutely bonkers. And I was actually down at the filming because I think the director thought, well, you know, let's get the girls in maybe on the filming. But once they'd seen Bowie and Jagger, they were like, okay, we don't need any more divas.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking that, like, you know, when you saw the movie Bohemian Rhapsody and the bit where the curtain opens and Queen go out, did that bring back something to you of just how mad that day actually was?
Totally. That was, I was actually kind of stopped in my tracks when I saw that, because that was exactly my point of view walking out onto that stage at Wembley Stadium all those years ago. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. My life is literally, you know, running before my eyes.
And, like, you know, you realize that a third of humanity supposedly watched that on the day itself in 1985. And, like, you just look back and you go, this is just crazy. When you're on stage with David Bowie, can I ask a question about, was he nervous?
I think he was, actually. I don't think it's possible to do a gig of that magnitude and not feel some kind of nerves. Plus, he got my name wrong at the end, so I guess he was a bit nervous.
Yeah, that's on the thing, all right. Well, just as a matter of interest, like, in terms of what you wear on stage, I mean, would he ever have anything to say about that? Or would he want his backing singers to wear... Like, I mean, so many times you see three female backing singers and it's all kind of a little black number kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. If I had a penny for every time I'd been asked to wear a little black dress, I'd be a wealthy woman by now. But at rehearsals, he actually sat myself and the other lady I was singing with, Helena Springs, down and said, so what are you wearing? And I was shocked, because I was used to working with rock and rollers who's, you know, if they put on a clean T-shirt for the gig, that was a result. So to have Bowie sit down, but of course it makes perfect sense because he was so into the aesthetic and the visual aspect of things. Yeah, and he says, so what are you wearing? And we immediately said, well, what are you wearing? He said, I'm wearing a blue suit. And we said, well, we'll team up with you and wear blue.
I get the impression for you it was a piece of cake. I mean, you've just gone around the world with what do you call them, the Police, and the cover of your book, Backtrack, The Voice Behind Music's Greatest Stars. I mean, Bowie looks as though he's looking up at you. I mean, looking up to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was just a magical experience. And I don't think anybody thought at the time that we would be talking about this 35, 36 years later.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, tell me then about Eric Clapton, because that happened after that, the August album from 86. And he was the one you probably worked with more than anybody in terms of touring, album, studio, all the rest.
Yeah, you're right, Dave. I was with Eric on and off for about 12 years, which was, you know, a fantastic experience. And I was introduced to him via a lady called Katie Kassoon. Now, some of your listeners may remember Mac and Katie Kassoon.
Yeah.
And she really kind of set the ball rolling for me with Eric. And she and I became partners in many other kind of musical experiences. We worked with Robbie Williams together, and we had this long relationship with Eric and the band, and it was just extraordinary. We went through a lot of difficult times with them too.
Yes, I'll get to that in a second. We just want to play. Are you on Layla with Eric Clapton?
The MTV Unplugged version.
Right, let's take a blast. So that's you singing. In fact, that was the first big MTV Unplugged thing, wasn't it? Or was it?
I think it was.
Indeed.
Eric's biggest album of all time.
Okay, so there were sad times as well with Eric Clapton, and one of the saddest, without a doubt, is August 27th, 1990. Now, this is a really strange thing that happens, because you're on tour and everything's going great, and Stevie Ray Vaughan is the support act, and Stevie Ray Vaughan leaves the gig in a helicopter and it crashes into a ski lift and everybody in the helicopter dies. So, like, and that included the agent, Billy Brooks, I think his name is, the bodyguard of Eric Clapton, Nigel, and also Chris Smith, the assistant tour manager, etc., and also Stevie Ray Vaughan, who was, let's face it, the most influential blues guitarist of the 1980s. Now, when that happened, and you could have been any one of you and all the rest, there was a thing of, obviously we call off the tour, but you didn't. And in retrospect, are you glad you didn't? But at the time you thought, wait a minute, we can't keep going.
Yeah, at the time I was devastated, and as was everybody else. And I had very much that kind of, well, the show kind of can't go on because we're all in a state. How can we stand on a stage and entertain feeling like this? But, you know, ultimately, I think we were led by Eric, who just felt, you know, we had a duty and it would have been fitting and a tribute to those that died. And he was right. And so I am glad we did.
At that time, were you also doing jingles as well, and also, you know, playing with whoever wanted you to play with? Right in the middle of Clapton, were you in the studio singing for? God, I had a list of them earlier on. Oh, yeah, here's some of them. For Barbie, Levi's, Cadillac, Diet Pepsi, Delta Air, DHL. Were you doing them at the time?
I was. I'd come back off tour and I would kind of dive back into studio work, which I absolutely love, Dave. I mean, it's just, you know, they're very different mediums in a way, you know, the live thing and the studio thing. Studio is much more controlled, but I've always loved it.
And also, like, some of the times you would never have met the artist that you were, that you'll find yourself singing on their hits. Now, I know, like, with What's Love Got to Do With It with Tina Turner, you didn't meet her, but then you did meet her for Simply the Best. So were you in the studio with her, and what was she like?
Oh, well, if you can imagine 50,000 light bulbs going off in terms of energy, and I mean, she's just extraordinary. When she walks into a room, it literally is lit up. And I'm not going to lie, she's a presence. She's intimidating. But she was fantastic as well. I mean, she came in, and standing side by side and singing with her was just a real pinch me moment. And just loved performing on those tracks. Yeah, as I say, I didn't meet her on What's Love Got to Do With It. But on Simply the Best, yeah.
And also Grace Jones. I mean, like, you wouldn't have met her necessarily doing Slave to the Rhythm, but when you hear Slave to the Rhythm back, I presume you listen out all the time for, you know, how much of, like, you might do 5 or 6 hours and you hear, like, okay, they've used that bit. They haven't used any of that bit, though.
No, exactly. And that's classic Trevor Horn, the producer. He would get me in and literally have me get out every single thing in my toolbox to possibly sing and try and impress him. And then one thing would end up on the record. But that one thing, you know, totally cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, can I get back to some silly bits? Benny Hill, did you audition for Benny Hill?
I did. And it was, you know, a travesty, really, because I am not a dancer. But I actually called him up. Somebody gave me his phone number. I must have been 19. And of course, you're fearless at that age, aren't you? Now, I mean, I just hold my head in my hands thinking, oh, my God, I actually called Benny Hill. He could not have been more charming, not in a kind of salacious way that perhaps people have a perception of. He was so kind and so generous, and he said, well, look, we're not looking for singers, but come down and you know, audition. So I did, and you know, it was a ridiculous scenario, and it was a hot day, and I had a wig on, and even though I didn't, you know, plan for this, my wig fell off during the dance rehearsal. I mean, it was a disaster, but he was lovely. And it was a great experience for someone so young.
Okay, by the way, we're talking Backtrack, the voice behind music's greatest stars. It's the book by Tessa Niles. And Tessa, like, obviously, like, you're going to say everybody was great and all that, but can I just mention one person? Like, not everybody can be as great as everybody else, right? Okay. Now, the one very famous singer who was famous for his hair, Michael Bolton, how was he?
That could have been anyone, actually, famous. Yeah, you know what? Obviously, there are times when people are not kind of that interested in you and very wrapped up in their own stuff. And as a session singer, as a backing singer, you kind of get used to that because you're not looking to pull focus yourself. You know, you are there to support the artist. But yeah, sometimes there were people who were just not that nice. Yeah, Michael was one of those.
And were you ever with somebody, and I get the impression that I could probably say Tears for Fears here, where you could see that things weren't really going as well as you would hope they would have? You didn't realise that, oh, these guys maybe are splitting up a bit, you know, Roland and Kurt.
Yeah, I mean, there was that feeling. I mean, because I worked on the album over a considerable amount of time. I think if you normally went in and just worked on the odd session, you know, you wouldn't get that a feel for that dynamic between them. But I was working on it for a matter of months and working on different tracks. And yeah, it was apparent that, you know, that it was all was not well in the camp. But, you know, they came out with this phenomenal piece of work.
Mm. When you did the concert for George, I presume, would that be Eric Clapton saying, hey, you know, you're definitely coming with me. We really need you on stage for this thing tonight because it's huge.
Yeah, it was a combination of him and George's widow, Olivia Harrison, who we'd got very close to, Katie and I, when we worked in Japan with George. And yeah, it was a no-brainer for her. She wanted us there too.
And throughout the whole career, and you do mention a few names like Katie Kassoon, obviously, but I mean, Trevor Horn, was he big for you? When you did Lexicon of Love for ABC, was that a big, huge kind of, was that another door opening?
Oh, that was the absolute, you know, pinnacle really of my career thus far, and really did, Dave, open the doors for so many other things. Because if you remember, I'm sure you do, we all, so many of us do, that we would scour the backs of albums and to see who played on what and who performed on what. And even if we didn't know them, these names kind of popped up and they became your calling card. And so working with Trevor over many, many years, if not decades, was such a fantastic thing for me, because it really, you know, people saw my name on his work and I got so much more work from it.
Yeah, I mean, like Trevor Horn, in terms of production, I don't know what he's most famous for, but everything from, well, Frankie Goes to Hollywood is always one I do remember that. But like producers themselves, Trevor Horn, anybody else at all, I presume they all demand something different.
They do. They do. They're very, very different. Some of them know exactly what they want and they direct you accordingly. And there's no real movement from that because they have that vision. Other producers want you to go in and create something. Trevor was kind of a combination of both for me. He knew what he wanted, but he would always want me to bring something special and try something. Even if it was radical and bizarre, he'd want me to try it.
And Chris Kimsey, I mean, the Stones guy, you know, the whole thing in terms of like, he mentioned something like about what you do is you sprinkle fairy dust. And like, is that the way you saw it? Kind of, it's just like, you know, whatever is done, now we put it in there that'll stay forever in people's minds.
I think so. And I think what we do as harmony singers, as session singers, is create that little bit of magic. Very often I would come into the proceedings at the end of the recording. You know, I'd be some of the last things to go on to the actual track. So I think to have that female element as well, because, you know, many of the tracks were largely put together by men, was also very different, you know, brought in a different dynamic to things. And we would just boost the chorus. You know, we would provide that hooky-ness behind the song that would really boost that chorus into hyperspace.
Okay, I'm going to play this here. Are you ready for a second? It lasts for 1 second. Hold on. Do you know what that is?
I think I do. Yes. It's so funny that you isolated it.
Yeah, hold on, I'm going to do it one more time. Hold on. Brilliant. That's you. Okay. Because that is like one of the bands you've worked with. I know Robbie Williams is a real special for you. And in fact, his quote on the cover of the book is hilarious. But anyway, what was I going to say? Yeah, that's Duran Duran. How many albums did you do? That's notorious. How many albums did you do with Duran Duran?
I think 5.
Yeah, 5. And I presume you loved working with them, did you?
Absolutely loved working with them. Plus, also the live stuff with them was always outrageously fun. I mean, the ultimate kind of party band, unbelievable tunes, and just, you know, they live for live work.
Yeah, indeed. Like, you know, so, like some of the stuff when you see Video Killed the Radio Star, Owner of a Lonely Heart, Slave to the Rhythm, you did all those with Trevor Horn. Do you like working with the one person who you get on with in the same way as you did for Clapton for so long?
Yeah, I think you build up that rapport. I think you almost know what they want, you know, without having to speak too much about it. And yeah, just such a privilege to work for Trevor, because he's really been on the cutting edge of so many songs from the last decade.
And touring schedules, they're so demanding and you don't really have a choice. I mean, if you want the gig, if you want to work, because like you're not the guy who says, OK, listen, I'll tell you what, we'll go on tour in 2023 for 3 months. Then, you know, you don't have much choice in that if this is what you work at, do you?
No, not at all. No, absolutely not. No, you're just kind of. But you see, the thing is, it's a young person's job, really. So, you know, you don't have perhaps the kind of things that would stop you from just basically, you know, packing a bag the night before and then going on tour. That's pretty easy when you're a certain age.
You know, the Oscar-winning movie, 20 Feet from Stardom, were you interviewed for that?
I wasn't, Dave.
And you should have been.
Even though I was applauding the fact that it was the first time for me that backing singers had really been hailed or heralded, you know, that they were given a platform, it was absolutely fantastic. But it was an American movie, and I just kept thinking, gosh, what about all the Brits? What about, you know, what about everybody else? Because we've contributed so much to these hits that are worldwide hits. So it just felt, and it felt a little bit, I'm not going to lie, that it was, there was an element of the poor me, I could have been a star aspect.
Well, hold on a second then. What about unsung heroes, the Brits behind the hits?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What was that exactly?
Well, that kind of came out of that, Dave. We, myself and my good friend and singing partner for many things, Gina Foster, we sat down and said, listen, we've got to do our own version of this. We've got to kind of set the record straight, if you'll pardon the pun. And so we wrote a review called Unsung Singers, The Brits Behind the Hits. And we have plans for a documentary as well to do our own version and to let people know about the Brits.
And you put one foot into the water of a solo career, and you do seem to say that, like, you know, maybe you didn't have the drive. Surely with 80% of what you've seen, and surely with 80% of what you might have been doing there, 80% of it is luck.
Yeah, huge amount of luck. Huge amount. I mean, you know, anybody who doesn't think that is kind of delusional, really, I think, because you have to be in the right place at the right time. Yeah, you've got to be able to deliver on that luck. But gosh, if you're not there in the arena, shall we say, you know, you're not going to get a look in.
Yeah, exactly. But hold on, so we have a text there saying play more of that thing. Hold on. Well, that's you in amongst all that lot. We're talking to Tessa Niles here. Just a few more bits and pieces I want to mention. That's Notorious. That's Duran Duran. Now, somebody else, as I say, somebody you get on really well with is this guy. Come on! All right, tell me about, you do say sometimes that your favourite gig was Nebworth with Robbie Williams. So how was Robbie to work with?
Oh, gosh, Dave, honestly, I was just doing my full-on 70s moves here at the microphone. He was the most fun person to work with. And also just incredibly talented. And contrary again to kind of his persona and his public image, he's a really serious guy about what he does and his art and stuff. And I think people see him as this cheeky chappy and it's very throwaway and all of that. But he's so skilled. He's such a skilled showman. And he was a joy to work with. Absolute joy.
And like, I presume in Nebworth, you were probably singing to more people than even at Live Aid, were you?
Yeah, I think it was something like a quarter of a million people.
Ah, yeah. Okay, fair
three
enough.
Nights, something like that. Something mad. Nights, yeah. Not quite as big as Live Aid, right. Just because that was kind of broadcast around the world. Night, but it was huge and epic. And he really was at his zenith, I think, at that point. He was just, you know, he had all the great tracks. And I was so fortunate to have recorded Rock DJ with him. And that was the first time I met him.
Yeah, when that video came out, it was just absolutely huge. Do you think that to be a backing singer that you really have to have a very small ego? I mean, they mentioned earlier on about the solo career, possibly, but like, are you ever behind the singer thinking, holy cow, I could do better than that?
Well, inevitably, you know, there are people that you work with who are just not that great. You know, they've got other aspects that make them into, you know, that pull them into the public eye. But most of the time, no, you know what? Honestly, I'm not devoid of ego. I mean, I think to be able to stand on a stage, you've got to have a certain amount of, you know, amount of that going. But just it always sat so well for me to be able to support others. Yeah, never had a problem with it. Never felt, oh, I should be there instead of you. No, never had that.
Right, indeed. Well, listen, finally, touring, I presume, puts a huge strain on you physically, emotionally and all the rest. So there's a common time when you say, you know, I need to pull back. You just mentioned it was a young person's game earlier on.
Yeah, I think so. I think there definitely, for me, by the time I was, you know, having children, that was kind of the thing that put the lid on it, I suppose, for me, certainly for live work, because I didn't want to be touring and bringing up kids. That didn't work for me. So I did bow out, shall we say, gracefully.
Oh, and by the way, where are you living now? Are you living in South Africa?
No, I'm in the UK. I'm in the county of Lincolnshire.
Oh, very good. Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much, Tess. It's been fantastic for talking with us on the programme today. It is Tessa Niles. And that book is there. It's called Backtrack, The Voice Behind Music's Greatest Stars. And every story, we've just touched on a few there, every story is in there. I'm going to play a tiny bit of this to go out, though. And this is like, you can really hear you on this one here more than probably a lot of the stuff. And this is Come Undone with Duran Duran. Tessa, thanks a million. Take it easy.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you.
2FM.